We'll hear argument next in Petróleos to Venezuela, the MUFG Union Bank, 23858 and 24127. And as I understand it, counsel for the appellants, followed by Amicus, the Republic, will argue. Mr. Gottlieb, Mr. Bliss, thereafter Mr. Verrilli. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so Mr. Gottlieb, you can proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Mike Gottlieb from Wilkie Farr and Gallagher, representing appellant PDV Holding. I'll be addressing the act of state and comity issues for appellants, and my colleague, Mr. Bliss, will be addressing the New York choice of law issues. The decision below violated the act of state doctrine because it denied legal effect to official sovereign acts of the Venezuelan National Assembly disapproving the issuance of the PDVSA 2020 bonds. Unlike some act of state cases, here there is no factual dispute about what the National Assembly did. Everyone agrees on the words the Assembly enacted into law when it published official resolutions in May and September of 2016. Instead, the decision below and all of Appellee's arguments turn entirely on the legal effect that is to be given to those words in the Assembly's acts.
But with respect to these particular notes, why isn't it correct to view what happened as a failure to act? And thereafter, can we consider a failure to act as a sort of formal act that's subject to the act of state doctrine?
I think, respectfully, Your Honor, there's no way to view the National Assembly's actions as a failure to act. The National Assembly, in enacting the September 2016 resolution, exercised its constitutional oversight powers over the exchange. It expressly called for a hearing. It considered the only transaction that was then on the table. It enacted a resolution disapproving of that transaction and called for an investigation by the public ministry, which is the equivalent of submitting the matter to a criminal investigation by the Justice Department in this country. So I don't think that the National Assembly's actions can be construed as simply not acting. It considered the exchange and rejected it. It would be the same thing as the United States Senate considering a treaty, voting it down, and then referring the matter for a criminal investigation to the Justice Department. That is an exercise of the Senate's powers to review a treaty in the same way this was an exercise of the National Assembly's constitutional authorities to review the proposed transactions and to reject them. And that rejection was not equivocal. It was unequivocal. It was a categorical.
But your view would have been the same, as I understand it, but you can correct this. Even if the September 2016 resolution did not pass, based entirely on the prior May 2016 resolution, right?
I think there's two ways to look at that argument, Your Honor. I think the question of Venezuelan law would probably be the same, because the question of Venezuelan law turns on the approval by the National Assembly. The act of state argument is different, and I think our argument is different given that we recognize that there is a requirement under the act of state doctrine that an act must be official. There has to be some kind of formal action by the other government.
That's what my question is designed to get at, yes.
And I don't think our argument would be the same. Our argument is that the September resolution exercised the constitutional power to approve or disapprove a particular class of contracts. I don't think our argument would be the same if the National Assembly had simply done nothing. Now, we do think there are cases that address disapprovals, for example, the disapproval of the passport request in Underhill. We've cited some other cases for that proposition in our briefs, but we don't think this court needs to go there because we think that what the National Assembly did here was clearly an act. It was the enactment of a resolution that rejected a proposed exchange, and it called for additional actions to take place in the government. That action deprived PDVSA of legal authority to move forward with the transaction. And the May resolution makes quite clear that in that context, that the National Assembly's position, at least, is that that rendered the transaction void ab initio from the start, as if the transaction did not exist.
It seems that in the active state cases, for the most part, they involve refraining from invalidating an act of a foreign sovereign on the basis of international law. In this case, what I understand the argument to be is that we were called upon to apply the act of state doctrine in order to give effect to Venezuela law with respect to essentially what was an interbranch dispute at the time between the executive branch and the legislative branch. Is there a case that's sort of more analogous to that scenario where we're being asked to use the doctrine to apply someone's own national law?
Well, I think there are both responses to that about the law of act of state doctrine and with respect to what the district court did in this case. I'd like to try to address both of them. With respect to the act of state doctrine, the Kirkpatrick case is clear that what the Supreme Court meant by invalidating was to deny legal effect to an act. In other words, for a U.S. court to take a look at an act of a foreign government and say, yeah, we're not going to give that legal effect in our court. And some of the cases say
without declaring it unlawful per se, just denying legal effect.
That's right. I mean, in Sabatino, for example, the issue wasn't whether the Cuban decree would have been wiped off the books. The question was whether the decree was going to be given effect in the context of a dispute in New York court over who had title to funds here. The same is true in Ochin, where the Hydes were in the United States. The same is true in the FTE versus Spirits International case, where the trademarks in question were in the United States. And the question was whether to give effect to a Russian decree over an assignment. So I think the law and all of the examples that are given in the Supreme Court's Kirkpatrick case align with that. Then with respect to this case, I think there's a few different ways that the district court violated the act of state doctrine. The first way it violated the act of state doctrine was that it did not accept the validity of the resolutions as explained by the resolutions themselves and by explained by the Republic in this case. In other words, the district court said, I hear what you're saying, but I don't believe that that was the intent or the effect of the resolutions that you passed. And this court in FTE said, you cannot do that. You cannot second guess the intent and effect under foreign law of the acts, official acts of a foreign sovereign. But then specifically, I don't think you can square the act of state doctrine with the court's judgment itself. And what makes this case different is that you have both claims and counterclaims in the case. And the counterclaims that the appellees advanced were counterclaims to expressly declare the validity of the notes. And they included requests that the district court granted to hold that PDVSA had actual legal authority to enter into the transaction and that Venezuelan law did not affect the legality, validity, or enforceability of the notes. Granting those counterclaims invalidated the National Assembly's disapproval. And in that sense, it's incompatible with the act of state doctrine. But then the last way that the district court's decision is incompatible with the act of state doctrine is at pages 42 through 43 of the special appendix, the sort of most expansive part of the holding, the district court held that even if the National Assembly had invalidated the exchange before the transaction closed, that act would be unworthy of recognition because of the extraterritorial takings exception. And that component of the holding is incompatible with the act of state doctrine. And it's remarkable because everybody agrees there was no taking in this case. It's black letter law that property rights can't be taken before they come into existence. And if affirmed,
does everybody in fact agree on that?
I don't understand the defendants to be, or the appellees to be arguing otherwise. Their argument is essentially that because the National Assembly's acts couldn't come to fruition within Venezuela, they fall within the Allied Bank exception.
Right.
But that's not faithful to Allied Bank. Allied Bank says that the foreign act must be evaluated, the situs of the debt, excuse me, has to be evaluated at the time of the foreign act in question. And every case that has ever applied Allied Bank has followed that. And in particular, this court's decision in FTE versus Spirits International confronted precisely the same argument. The argument that the district court made was the Russian assignment, I don't have to give effect to it because it is designed to affect trademarks in the United States. And this court, in reversing that, said, no, the fact that there are trademarks in the United States is not the question. The question is, the act was an act of a foreign sovereign within Russia to allocate rights and responsibilities within the Russian government and the Russian state, and therefore Allied Bank doesn't apply.
Article 150 gives to the National Assembly this power with respect to state or national public interest contracts, not any other form of property or contract. And one thing that seemed to me odd about your side of the argument is that the resolution of September 2016 did not make a finding to the effect that the contract in question was a national public interest contract.
Your Honor, so I think there's a few problems with that. The first is that the Republic has appeared before this court and contradicted that. In other words, they've said the fact that they did not include those words does not mean that the resolution does not, in fact, have that legal effect. But there's a couple of other problems with it. The one is that the September resolution was enacted in the context and just a few months after the May resolution. And the May resolution very clearly does include a definition of what would constitute a public interest contract. And the relevant section of this appears at page 3515 of the joint appendix. In that resolution, the National Assembly said, quote, those contracts that could seriously compromise the assets of the Republic or expose them to serious losses or international claims that might be detrimental to the sovereignty or integrity of the country shall be deemed to be contracts of national public interest.
Would that encompass every contract that PDVSA executes?
No, it would not, because PDVSA can execute numbers of contracts that wouldn't be, for example, with foreign nationals. It could execute numerous contracts that wouldn't meet the qualitative criteria of potentially significantly compromising the assets of the Republic. But the point is, the September resolution is unequivocal at pages 110 to 111 of the joint appendix, that this transaction did compromise the assets of the Republic, because this transaction, unlike any transaction that had come before it, pledged the most, what was thought of as the crown jewel or the most strategic asset of the Republic. So the National Assembly was quite clear.
Well, nonetheless, it seems to me nonetheless that when one looks at the September 2016 resolution, and tries to figure out what it is, what it means, what it is doing. It's somewhat ambiguous, because it doesn't ever come out and say that the National Assembly is withholding approval under Article 150 of this particular contract. It expresses disapproval of the collateral, and expresses points of view, and asks for an investigation. But how does one determine, looking at that piece of law, that what has been done here is the express withholding of disapproval of approval for this particular contract, deeming it to be a national public interest contract? Because the National Assembly can disapprove of lots of contracts and put their disapproval into writing, but they only have, but that only has the effect that you're arguing this has if it is a national public interest contract. And does one need to do an economic investigation to determine whether the contract in question has the qualities that would make it a national public interest contract? So it seems to me that it's scarcely apparent. Indeed, it appears not to be the case that the September 16th resolution was a withholding of Article 150 approval.
Well, I think, Your Honor, respectfully, the May resolution establishes the legal principle that no one has disputed, that a national public interest contract that is executed without the Assembly's approval is null and void ab initio. So we begin with that premise.
Right.
Then the question is, well, they didn't, there's sort of two points that I understand Your Honor to be making. One is, they didn't say in September that it would be null and void if enacted, and they didn't say it was a national public interest contract. So with respect to the first point, they said in May, if it was a national public interest contract and they didn't approve it, it would be null and void.
Well, they didn't even have to say that. The law says that. The Article 150 says that. If it's a national public interest contract, it requires the approval of the Assembly.
Correct. But also, it's important to note, and this has never been disputed, this resolution was enacted at the end of September. The transaction was still a proposal at this point. It could have mm-hmm. been withdrawn. It could have been changed. And in fact, that's what the Assembly was asking PDVSA to do. It said, come back to us with a different plan. We are disapproving this temporarily at the moment. Come back with a different plan. Maybe we'll approve it. But then it seems to me
that what you've just said can be construed as being contrary to your position, because all they're saying is we don't like this. when you get something in writing, maybe we'll look at it then, maybe we'll approve it. But right now, we're just telling you we don't like what you've done here.
That would be the case if the Constitution provided that a national public interest contract was valid unless rejected by the National Assembly. But the Constitution, of course, provides the opposite. And the National Assembly was very clear.
But you haven't answered the question. When does it become established that the contract in question was a national public interest contract subject to the provisions of Article 150?
The other point I was trying to make, Your Honor, is that the provision that is invoked by the National Assembly in the September resolution, and it's invoked twice, is Article 187, Section 9. And Article 187, Section 9 has one and only one authority that is provided in it, and that is the authority to approve or not approve national public interest contracts. The National Assembly invoked that authority in the virtually the same breath as it rejected categorically the pledge of the shares of Citgo Holding. Now, the only answer that has been given to that by the district court and appellees is that the only purpose of them invoking that was to call for an investigation. But that's not an answer, because to call for an investigation is the same thing as to not approve at the point in time. But second of all, the investigation that they were calling for was an investigation by the public ministry. It was a criminal investigation referring the people to the public ministry, which is the equivalent of the
public. In addition to that, Mr. Ghalib, I thought you might also say that, you know, in this exchange with Judge LaValle, how do we interpret? What tools do we use to interpret this resolution? Are they tools that are available under our law, or are they tools that are available by resorting to Venezuelan law? And can you unpackage that for us?
Yeah. So I think that fundamentally, the active state doctrine is a question of United States federal law. And the guidance on this comes from the Supreme Court's decision in Ricoud versus American Metal, the 1918 decision. This court has quoted it numerous times. And that guidance is, when it is made to appear that a foreign sovereign has acted on the subject matter of a question, U.S. courts are not supposed to get into the nitty-gritty and details and ask if it was in the right form and ask if it was published in the Official Gazette. They're supposed to sort of accept it at face value. To the extent there is a doubt about that, when you have the sovereign that has appeared to explain the meaning of its laws, clearly under this court decision in Karaha Bodas and Animal Science, that furnishes as a device to assist in that interpretation. But foreign law is only supposed to be used under the active state doctrine. Foreign law is supposed to be used for the purposes of determining whether an act is official. In other words, you can look at foreign law, foreign constitutions, foreign statutes, you can scrutinize them to determine if the act constituted the official act of the state. Once you get past that threshold question, you're not supposed to be digging into the details of whether the act of the foreign sovereign in that question was effective. You're not supposed to ask whether the National Assembly effectively conveyed its disapproval, as Venezuelan law might consider. That was the precise holding of this court in FTE versus Spirits International. It was also the holding of this court in the Banco de España case, where arguments were made that the decrees of the Spanish government didn't meet the right form. They weren't given the proper notice because they were secret. All of those arguments were made in Banco de España and rejected by this court.
What was the other case you mentioned together with Banco de España?
FTE versus Spirits.
Okay, thank you.
At its heart, the active state doctrine is motivated by a desire to keep the judicial branch out of the executive branch's business, things that our coordinate branches are much better placed to address. I read the United States' position in this case as essentially saying, you courts resolve these questions as a matter of law, whether it be choice of law or whatnot, and we have the tools to effectuate our foreign policy at the next stage when it comes to actually licensing or not licensing the transfer of these assets. How does that fit into, or should that fit into, our analysis of whether we should invoke this discretionary doctrine?
Well, I think the first thing to note is that it is a stunning contrast from the United States' submission to this court in Allied Bank, where the United States took a very, very strong position that the court should adjudicate the foreign, essentially the foreign legal question, because of the U.S. policy interests at stake. So this is a significant departure from where the United States was an allied bank. And essentially, I mean, the United States government is saying it's not taking a position on whether the active state doctrine applies, and it's leaving that question to this court. The U.S. government said there were important questions of Venezuelan law and other questions that needed to be resolved. But fundamentally, the active state doctrine is a judicial question. It's not an abstention doctrine. It's a rule of decision that supplies principles that the court has to accept. And it is entirely consistent with the U.S. government's position in this case for this court to say that it is bad for foreign policy and international comity for us to be interpreting acts of the Venezuelan National Assembly in a manner that is flatly inconsistent with their text, flatly inconsistent with what the National Assembly said before this litigation, and is flatly inconsistent with what the Republic has appeared before this court and explained to the court the meaning of those resolutions are. And the active state cases are concerned with drawing the U.S. judiciary into a conflicting position with a foreign sovereign's interpretation of its own law. And that's exactly what we would have here. We would have a United States.
This is the comedy part of your argument that you wanted to get to.
Yes, I think that it's a separate argument about the weight that ought to be given to the submission of the Republic in this case, but also a reason why the court should accept as a rule of decision the acts of the Venezuelan National Assembly here, and that is that the Republic's official representative has appeared before the court. It has offered a thorough, consistent, and clear position. And the only rationales for rejecting that position in the court below are either easily rebutted or have essentially been foreclosed by this court's decision in Animal Science.
So does that mean that you are rejecting the first part of Judge Robinson's question, in which she said that the heart of the active state doctrine is a purpose to protect the United States government in its dealings with foreign nations?
No, we accept that, but this court has nonetheless said in cases, for example, like Allied Bank, that fundamentally the doctrine remains a doctrine for the court to apply. And there are many situations in which the U.S. government essentially takes a position of neutrality in a case. The fact that the U.S. government takes a position of neutrality doesn't mean that there aren't separation of powers concerns. And here there really are separations of powers concerns because the executive branch going back to 2015.
So are you saying that the answer given by the U.S. government to the court's inquiry is irrelevant, that it really doesn't matter what the government says, that even if the government said, enforce the rights, notwithstanding the act of the foreign state, No. Disregard the action of the foreign state. Don't apply the active state doctrine. Courts should still do it.
No, Your Honor. I'm saying it's highly relevant. That's why I began by contrasting the U.S. government's submission in this case with its submission in Allied Bank. I mean, there are cases where the United States comes in and says, apply the active state doctrine here. There are cases where the United States comes in and says, do not apply the active state doctrine here. And this is a case where the United States has come in and said, it's up to the court. We're not taking a position on it.
We don't care.
Well, what it said, as I understand it, was there are antecedent issues that need to be resolved before the active state doctrine really comes to become a central issue.
That the United States was saying there are antecedent issues before the United States would feel comfortable taking a position.
Right.
And I think that those antecedent issues are precisely the ones that I began my argument with, which are the meaning of these acts of the National Assembly, the meaning of these resolutions under Venezuelan law, which had been disputed by the parties from the start. And it is the rejection of the meaning of those resolutions that is provided, we think, by the text of the resolutions, by the historical context of the resolutions, and by the clarity offered by the Republican submission. It is the rejection of that we believe violates the active state doctrine in this case.
When we get to the choice of law issue, I think I hear both parties say that if we conclude that Venezuela law should govern the question of whether or not the notes were valid in light of the absence of approval of the National Assembly, we should remand that question of what Venezuela law actually requires to the district court, because that hasn't been fully developed. It's not been what's briefed here, et cetera. But what I hear when we're talking about the active state doctrine is that we, at some level, should get into that question, or maybe what I'm hearing is we should take at face value the National Assembly's representation for purposes of the active state doctrine. There feels like a tension between those in terms of what we should be doing or not doing.
Yeah, I think the two doctrines overlap. I think that with respect to, so it is clear that the district court did not make a formal Rule 44.1 finding on the meaning of foreign law. And so to the extent that we were to prevail on the choice of law issue and Venezuelan law needed to be decided, you know, the court would need to make such a determination. The active state doctrine might well play into that determination by supplying a rule of decision on the meaning of Venezuelan law with respect to certain questions. So, for example, we think that the resolutions supply a rule of decision on the legal question whether PDVSA had legal authority to enter into the transactions as a matter of Venezuelan law. We think those acts decide that question in the negative, and that needs to be accepted as a rule of decision for the court if deciding the issue. That doesn't mean there might be other issues that the court, you know, that doesn't mean that would be the only issue that the court would need to decide. But we do think the active state doctrine supplies that rule of decision with respect to the National Assembly's rejection of the transaction, with respect to PDVSA's legal authority to enter into it, with respect to the question, at least under Venezuelan law, if there is a national public interest contract that is not approved by the National Assembly, whether that is void ab initio. We think the May resolution supplies the rule of decision for that legal question.
Okay. In response to a prior question that I asked, you pointed out that the 2016, September 2016 resolution included within it the reference to a section that refers exclusively to Section 150. But my further question is that in that context, why isn't that reference? I mean, you say that is necessarily referring to a national public interest contract, but why isn't it referring to the need to establish whether this is a national public interest contract? In view of the way the resolution is stated, it never says we are withholding approval on the basis that this is a national public interest contract and we withhold or we do not give approval. It simply says it expresses disapproval of a contract that's envisioned, it's in the making, and it asks for an investigation and makes reference to the doctrine that would give it the authority to not give approval and thereby make invalid a contract that requires its approval. But why does the reference, implicit reference or one step removed reference to Section 150, Article 150, mean that the Assembly has determined that this is a national public interest contract as opposed to raising the question whether it is?
Well, I think that the May resolution describes what the National Assembly would do if it had a national public interest contract in front of it. For example, it says the whereas clause before the one that I quoted from says, upon examining the contracts of public interest, the legislature has the possibility of demanding certain special conditions, such as financial guarantees and precautions of another nature. It's exactly what the National Assembly was doing in September. And then I think as a factual matter, Your Honor, that the other point that, I mean, I've mentioned all of the different provisions of the text of the September resolution. There's another factual point that's never been disputed, which is that the National Assembly commissioned a legal opinion contemporaneously with the—
This is the special attorney general, right?
No, it is not, Your Honor. There's a legal opinion that the National Assembly commissioned in 2016 at the same time it was considering this transaction by Professor Carmona. We cite this—
Professor Carmona.
And that legal opinion that the National Assembly Commission concluded that the exchange was a national public interest contract subject to the National Assembly's approval. So the National Assembly asked—
You're cutting out, Mr. Ghalib, a little bit.
I apologize, Your Honor. Professor Carmona's opinion, which was commissioned contemporaneously and delivered to the National Assembly before the transaction closed, concluded that this was a national public interest contract that the National Assembly's, for which the National Assembly's approval was required as a condition of—
I mean, it seems to me that answer is more helpful to your adversary than to you. I mean, it seems to— I mean, your you're saying that they asked for an opinion, and the opinion was studied, and after study, the person who was commissioned to give the opinion came out with the decision that, in his view, it's a national public interest contract. Well, you're saying that then made it a national, it became a national public interest contract when the commission professor came to the conclusion that it was? I mean, it seems to me that what you're saying is answering my question to the effect, say, well, no, they were asking the professor to tell them whether, in his view, it is or it isn't a national public interest contract. And he came to a conclusion, but that wasn't necessarily the conclusion of the National Assembly. It could accept his conclusion or not. I mean, supposing if he had expressed the opposite conclusion, would that mean it wasn't a national public interest contract?
But Your Honor, it's never been suggested that the National Assembly actually approved the contract. No one is arguing that the National
Assembly
quietly or implicitly approved.
I know, but unless it was a national public interest contract, it's of no legal relevance what the National Assembly did or didn't do. It has to be a national public interest contract for the Assembly to have any role in the matter whatsoever.
Understood, Your Honor, but the qualitative criteria for what constitutes a national public interest contract are defined in the Constitution.
Mr. Gallip, I'm having trouble hearing you. I hear Judge LaValle and Judge Robinson very clearly. I just can't hear you.
Can you hear me, Your Honor?
Better, maybe, yeah.
Okay, all right. I'm sorry. I'm
Better.
I'm plugged in here.
Okay.
There are qualitative criteria in the Constitution for what constitutes a national public interest contract.
Maybe if you drop your microphone about a centimeter down.
How's this?
Better.
That's better.
Yeah.
Okay. There are qualitative criteria in the Constitution for what constitutes a national public interest contract. Those are laid out in Article 150. The National Assembly expressed its view about what those qualitative criteria are in May. I quoted from that provision before. And then in September, the National Assembly applied those qualitative criteria to the transaction in question and cited the constitutional provision that can only apply in the context in which the National Assembly is reviewing a national public interest contract. Article 187.9 contains—
But you're missing, you're also neglecting that clause includes two other articles, 302 and 303. What are those two other articles?
Those are the articles that talk about the importance of PDVSA and the oil industry to the Venezuelan Republic and the Venezuelan economy, and reserve PDVSA as the only company that is mentioned in the Venezuelan Constitution, reserve the shares of PDVSA to the state. And so they're talking about the protection of the petroleum industry as a national asset.
The clause purports, I think, to modify the term national property, or does it modify, in your view, more than that?
Yeah, I think that the articles 302 and 303 talk about the protection of the nation's property in the form of the petroleum industry. And I think that what Article 187.9 does is it provides the National Assembly the power and the exclusive power to approve contracts that affect the nation's property, and national public interest contracts, as I said, are defined by those qualitative criteria in the May resolution that echo Article 1.
And in any event, your bottom line argument on, I think, both, maybe at least with the comedy issue, is that you've got the Republic, you've got understanding that there may be issues with this Professor Carmona. You've got, I think, another opinion that interpret the September 2016 resolution in a way that obviously favors your side, your view that this was an official act that applies to a national public interest contract and that voids the notes at issue here.
I think that's right. And I also think that essentially by saying that, you know, the National Assembly didn't expressly declare and use the words, this is a national public interest contract, we would be effectively applying some kind of a clear statement rule to the actions of the foreign sovereign in order to give it effect. And there's just no support for that in the cases interpreting the active state doctrine. The rule under the Ricaud case is the opposite. And it is simply inconsistent with the Supreme Court's decisions under the.
Well, that's not really exactly what it is. It's not a finicky matter of whether the statement is clear enough. I mean, the issue is more along the lines of did the resolution have the effect that you are arguing that it did, or was it a resolution that says we really need to investigate this question to determine whether this would be a national public interest contract if it's brought into effect, and we're asking a professor to look into it and give a report to us, and expressing the view that we don't like the giving of the city's service stock as Citgo stock as collateral. Those are very different things. It's not a matter of saying, well, they didn't dot an I and cross a T. It's a question whether they were doing one thing or doing a very different thing, contemplating the possibility of doing the one that you argue, but after investigation and after a determination that this is a subject to 150.
So I think there's a factual and legal component to that question, Your Honor. As a factual matter, we just think it is implausible to read the resolution as saying we are calling for an investigation about whether this constitutes a national public interest contract. They were calling for an investigation about whether the transaction protected national property. And the reason that they were calling for that investigation was for two purposes. One, because they still could have provided approval to some form of a reform transaction at some point in the future. And two, they were referring the people who were involved in the matter for a criminal investigation. And then as a plain legal matter, if what we are debating is the legal effect of the words in the resolution, in other words, we're saying we are not sure whether the words that were enacted in this resolution had these.
This is my question. How do we resolve some ambiguity or debate about this?
So I think Ricaud says that you're not supposed to dig into that. You're sort of supposed to accept at face value what the purported effect is by the foreign sovereign. But even if you were going to dig into the issue and try to decide it as a matter of law, you would, I think, in a close case, have to defer to the Republic submission, and Mr. Verrilli, of course, can explain the Republic submission on that.
You say that we said that in Ricaud?
Ricaud is the Supreme Court decision that this court has quoted a number of times that says when it is made to appear that a foreign sovereign has acted in a given way on a matter, that essentially that adjudicating or second guessing that is not the proper role for the court. That's obviously a different question when you're interpreting whether an act is official or not. Courts have repeatedly held that it is appropriate to look in the form of that.
Well, Judge Robinson or Judge LaValle, any more questions?
Yeah, I have one more, if you may.
Of course.
Which is, would you explain a little more the pertinence of sections 302 and 303 with respect to what we're going into with respect to the September 16 resolution?
The investigation that the National Assembly called
for first, beginning with how do 302 and 303 figure into the resolution? Where do they fit? What does it say about 302 and 303?
So at page 111 of the joint appendix in the third resolution, that is the resolution where the National Assembly is calling for the public ministry to open an investigation. It cites three constitutional provisions. It cites Article 187.9, and then it cites Articles 302 and 303. And the relevance of those provisions is that the investigation that the National Assembly asked the public ministry to open was, quote, to determine if the current transaction protects the national property in accordance with those articles of the Venezuelan Constitution. In other words, it was saying, public ministry, you should investigate whether this proposed transaction is in accord with the provisions of the Venezuelan Constitution that reserve the shares of PDVSA to the state, that deem the petroleum industry to be essentially a critical asset of the people of Venezuela and the like. That's how those provisions fit into that resolution.
I see. Thank you. Now, one other question is, what would be the consequence? You have devoted all of your argument, all of your oral argument, and perhaps that's because of the questions you've been asked, to whether the September 16th resolution September 16 resolution is the pertinent one. But what would be the consequence if we determined that it wasn't the September 2016 resolution, but a subsequent resolution that undertook to designate this as a national public interest contract and make clear that it does not have the approval of the National Assembly? What would be the consequence of that?
So I gather Your Honor is referring to the October 2019 resolution and the question directly. We are not arguing for the application of the active state doctrine based on that resolution as it stands on its own. In other words, our argument is that the October 19 resolution provides supporting context to our understanding of the September 2016 resolution, because it uses the words reiterates and ratifies. But we are not arguing that the October 2019 resolution by itself.
In part, I take it because that might be a taking.
We recognize that under Allied Bank, in a situation where there is an effort to repudiate a debt whose situs is in the United States, the rule of Allied Bank apply. And the reason we think Allied Bank has no application here is we're not making that argument. We're not arguing for.
Okay. So you're putting all your eggs in the September 2016 basket.
We believe the May and September resolutions of 2016 provide the relevant acts that are entitled to active state deference.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bliss, I believe.
Yes, good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, James Bliss of Paul Hastings, addressing the choice of law issues for all appellants. I'd like to make two points regarding the interpretation of the term validity in Section 8110 of the Uniform Commercial Code, which provides that the validity of a security such as the PDVSA 2020 notes must be governed by the law of the issuer's jurisdiction, here Venezuela. Under the district court's interpretation, a constitutional provision requiring prior authorization for the issuance of a security as a precondition of valid contract formation nonetheless does not bear on the security's validity unless the provision has something, quote, specifically to do with the issuance of securities, unquote. But we know that the UCC drafters had in mind constitutional provisions that are not specific to the issuance of securities, but that, like Article 150 of the Venezuelan Constitution, can encompass an issuance of securities. The official comments to UCC 8202 cite two bond invalidity cases involving Colorado's constitutional debt limit for municipalities, which limits their power to, quote, contract any debt by loan in any form and does not mention securities at all. The official comments cite these cases as representing one strand of the common law estoppel doctrine that the validity rules in Section 8202 were intended to incorporate. My second point, Your Honors, is that there can be no dispute that validity encompasses, at a minimum, what the New York Bill Jacket for revised Article 8 referred to as, quote, corporate or other authority to issue securities. And even assuming that National Assembly authorization somehow doesn't count as corporate or other authority, there is no meaningful distinction in this case between corporate authorizations and governmental authorizations, because Article 150 of the Venezuelan Constitution operates as a limit on the corporate power of entities within Venezuela's public administration, such that if Article 150 governed the 2020 notes transaction, PDVSA had no corporate authority to issue the 2020 notes. In other words, PDVSA's corporate authorizations were themselves unauthorized because PDVSA had no corporate power to grant them.
The application of 8110 that you're advocating, is there any distinction based on the type of invalidity, or is filing the corporate annual minutes with the wrong office under local law would render some further acts invalid? I mean, is that kind of validity essentially imported into New York's law through Section 8110, as far as you're concerned, or is there some limiting principle that applies it only in the really big stuff like the constitutional violation?
Well, what I would say, Your Honor, is that when we examine all of the sources that we have at our disposal to try and glean the meaning of the term validity, a sense of validity emerges that has at its core a law that would require prior authorization of a security as part of the issuance process, as a limitation on the power of the issuer to issue the security, and the violation of which would render the issuance itself defective and the security not just unenforceable, but void ab initio. And Article 150 of the Venezuelan Constitution is just such a law.
Can you talk a little bit about the relationship between, I'm trying to get my head around New York law as it relates to the party's election of a choice of law and whether that applies not only to substantive New York law, but choice of law rules. And one of the things I'm trying to untangle is whether if we take the, I don't have any, the IB case, the one where the Court of Appeals basically said choice of law means New York substantive law, is this section of the UCC that you're relying on a choice of law provision that we should then ignore for purposes of evaluating the authority here?
No, definitely not, Your Honor, because General Obligations Law Section 5-1401 expressly carves out the choice of law provisions in the UCC. So UCC 8110 is a mandatory choice of law rule that overrides parties' contractual choice of New York law. The other point I would make with regard to the IRB decision is that the only holding in that case was that parties need not expressly exclude New York's choice of law provisions in order to avail themselves of substantive New York law. That case did not in any way hold that the inclusion in a contract of a New York choice of law provision renders non-New York law completely irrelevant under any circumstance. And those decisions don't address in any way.
If viewed it as a presumption, presumptively New York law would apply in the absence of anything to the contrary.
I'm not even sure I would call it a presumption, Your Honor. As I understand that case, the holding just has to do with what happens if the parties choose New York law, but don't expressly exclude New York's choice of law principles, which these sorts of provisions typically do. But in that case, it didn't. So the question was, what happens? Does the court have to perform a New York choice of law analysis as part of the choice of New York law, or does it just apply New York substantive law? That's the only question the Court of Appeals was answering in IRB. But we know there are situations that even when the parties choose New York law, non-New York law might apply. For example, when a provision like UCC 8110 mandates the application of another jurisdiction's law. Also, the power and authority of a corporate entity to enter into a transaction is always governed by the law under which that entity was organized. And so in this very case,
I find it very perplexing that there is no clear law on this provision, which one could view as a relatively fundamental provision relating to the validity of a security, particularly in New York. Particularly perplexed that there's no New York state law, at least none that's been identified to us or to me. Is that right, first of all?
If you're asking whether there are any New York cases interpreting the term validity under UCC
8110? And under 8110, no. Yes.
Yes. Yeah, Your Honor, I think the reason for that, and this is something that's pointed out in the official comments to either 8110 or 8202, These provisions don't come up very often because of the practice of obtaining opinion letters for transactions. And so transactions are vetted in advance, and these issues tend not to arise, although they do arise sometimes and have arisen in recent cases other than this one, and opinion letters aren't always correct, and they weren't here. But that would be my answer to the question of why no cases interpreting validity under these particular statutory provisions.
And everybody agrees that New York law applies with respect to 8110 if we get to that issue, right?
Yes, everyone agrees that if Article 150 authorization goes to validity within the meaning of UCC 8110, then UCC 8110 would require the application of Venezuelan law to the question of whether the 2020 notes were issued in violation of the Venezuelan Constitution.
Well, that's not quite my question, but...
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
But everyone agrees that if we get past some of the issues that your colleague was talking about, Mr. Gottlieb, then 8110 applies. So we've got to analyze 8110 under New York law.
Oh, yes. Yes, Your Honor. Yes, okay. The 8110 and then the choice of law rules regarding actual authority and illegality. And the court also ended up applying a grouping of contacts analysis. So there are four choice of law rules in play here.
All under New York law.
They are all New York choice of law rules. Correct, right. Your Honor.
Why shouldn't we certify those questions, given the magnitude of the issues and given also the fact that the New York Court of Appeals, the New York Appellate Division, it's a blank slate?
Well, Your Honor, in our estimation, the answers to these questions are sufficiently clear that certification wouldn't be warranted. But we would, of course, welcome the opportunity to present our arguments to the New York Court of Appeals on any questions this court might want to certify.
Okay. Judge Robinson, you
didn't... Yeah, I'm sorry. One of the things that's confusing me about the sort of menu of choice of law analyses before us is the logic of how they relate together. So there's a body of law, some of it's from the district courts in this circuit, some of it's New York law that talks about the extraordinary circumstances under which issues around authority are resolved with respect to foreign jurisdictions law, even if New York choice of law otherwise applies. In the context of a security, how do you even get to that body of law with 8110 existing, or is 8110 the body of law we have to apply?
I think if the question in the case is the validity of a security, then UCC 8110 would apply. If the transaction doesn't involve a security within the scope of Article 8, then these other choice of law rules would come into play. So, for example, the rule that I think Your Honor was alluding to a moment ago regarding actual authority, and in particular, the actual authority of a foreign state-owned entity to enter into a particular transaction under applicable foreign law. Courts in this circuit have consistently applied foreign law to evaluate the authority of foreign officials and foreign entities.
And so, but in those, some of those cases involved what looked to me like securities. And nobody talked about 8110, and they went straight to the theme is capital sort of holding. And I'm trying to figure out how you do that, or whether 8110 just wasn't raised or wasn't deemed to be applicable.
I understand the question, Your Honor. I don't think 8110 was raised in any of those cases. I don't know that any of those cases involved Article 8 securities.
Right.
So I just don't have an answer, Your Honor, to why 8110 wasn't raised in those.
It's a unique feature of Article 8, I take it.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. And the district court, in applying the rule on actual authority, concluded that actual authority. Well, let me back up. The court concluded that this rule is flatly inapplicable in this case, because actual authority isn't even an issue here. Notwithstanding that Article 150 speaks directly to the authority of Venezuelan public entities to enter into national public interest contracts. And even though the appellees in their first claim for declaratory relief allege that the notes were validly issued, among other reasons, because PDVSA had actual authority to issue them, the court reasoned that actual authority doesn't apply here because PDVSA was not acting as the agent of the National Assembly. In other words, the court framed this issue in terms of principal and agent law. But a number of the cases in this circuit dealing with this issue address, under the rubric of actual authority, the legal authority of a foreign state-owned entity to enter into a particular transaction. And so we think it was clear error to conclude that this rule doesn't apply on the basis of the district court's, based on the reasoning offered by the district court.
I don't disagree that there are quite a number of district court decisions from this circuit that look at the law of the foreign forum for determining the authority. What I'm less clear on is the legal hook. That line of authority exists, but its underpinnings, frankly, elude me a little bit. Could you talk a little bit about why that's an appropriate rule of law to have developed?
Because I think at the end of the day, Your Honor, the actual authority of a foreign state-owned entity can only be determined under the law of the foreign state. And I think that's really what Judge Kodal was getting at in the Republic of Benin case, when he said, even if New York law applies, New York law has to look to Benin law to determine the authority of particular officers to act on the government's behalf. It's just the nature of the question. Now, I think what your Honor is referring to is that the courts take different approaches to this. Some courts refer to a grouping of contacts analysis, but don't really go through a multi-factor test and just say, if we enforce these contracts, the foreign government or its instrumentality will be exposed to massive liability. And so the foreign state has the most significant interest. But other courts, such as in the Storr case and in the Anglo-Iberia case, the court just applied foreign law to actual authority without even referring to a choice of law analysis.
And what's puzzling me is there were choice of law provisions in those contracts that chose New York law. So I'm trying to figure out how they got out from under that.
Yeah, I think they got out from under that, again, because everyone understands that the powers and authorities of an entity to enter into a transaction have to be governed by the law of that entity's jurisdiction. And I would emphasize that in this very case, the opinion letters addressed the issues of actual authority and PDVSA's ability to enter into this transaction legally as matters of Venezuelan law, as one would expect. So I think what's going on in those cases is that the courts understood intuitively that foreign law has to govern the question of at least actual authority. And then certain courts felt it appropriate to couch that analysis in terms of grouping of contacts or most significant relationship. And
how do you reconcile the position you're arguing with Section 203A of the New York Business Corporation Law, which says explicitly that no act of a corporation otherwise lawful shall be invalid by reason of the fact that the corporation was without the capacity or power to do the act? Isn't that exactly the argument that you're making, that because of the failure of the National Assembly to authorize the contract, the corporation was without capacity or power to establish these securities with this collateral?
Yes, Your Honor, but Business Corporation Law Section 203 applies only if New York law governs the actual authority issue in the first place. In other words, it doesn't just automatically apply because we're in New York court. And I think that's why BCL 203 doesn't come up in any of those actual authority cases Secondly, the ability of a securities issuer to assert that a security was invalid or is invalid because it was defectively issued is specifically governed by Article 8 of the UCC, as we've been discussing. And also, New York law has not eliminated the ultra-virus defense for government entities. And we cite the Parsa case from the New York Court of Appeals, 1984, which involved a contract between a doctor and a state-owned hospital. And that contract hadn't been authorized as required by New York law. The Court of Appeals recognized in that case that a party contracting with the state is chargeable with knowledge of the statutes which regulate its contracting powers and is bound by them. And so it's worth emphasizing that PDVSA is part of the Venezuelan state in the relevant sense that as a state-owned entity within Venezuela's national public administration, it is subject to Venezuelan public law, including the same laws going to the power of power to enter into contracts as organs of the government itself.
Seeing no further questions from my colleagues, you've also reserved some time for rebuttal, Mr. Bliss, so I'm sure we'll see you again. We'll hear from the Republic, Mikas, Mr. Verrilli.
May it please the court. I'm Don Verrilli for the Republic of Venezuela as amicus. The Republic thanks the court for this opportunity to be heard. I think it's evident from the discussion so far this morning that the meaning and effect of the September 2016 resolution is of paramount importance. So let me go directly to that question. Under a correct understanding of the law of Venezuela, the September 2016 resolution was a sovereign act. It was a definitive exercise of the National Assembly's Article 187 authority. It was a categorical rejection of the core term of the 2020 notes contract, the pledge of a majority stake in Citgo, and its legal effect was to render the offering of the 2020 notes void ab initio, because neither the executive nor PDVSA, acting at the executive's behest, had the constitutional authority to enter into that contract. Now, I'd like to make a couple of specific points to show why that is so, and then I think a more important overarching point. Specifically, the September resolution unambiguously invokes Article 187 and unambiguously rejects categorically the pledge of the majority shares in Citgo. Our submission is that the only way to understand that is that it is an assertion of jurisdiction, of authority by the National Assembly under Articles 150 and 187 over this contract, meaning it is a national public interest contract. Now, the broader point, if I might, Articles 150 and 187 delegate to the National Assembly the authority to determine what the category of national public interest contracts consists of. And my friend, Mr. Gottlieb, made this point in his argument, but if the court will indulge me, I think it needs to be repeated because it's of critical importance. The May 2016 resolution, and this is at JA 3515, by the National Assembly exercised that delegated authority to define what constitutes a national public interest contract. And it is a contract, a major procurement that could seriously compromise the assets of the Republic or expose them to serious losses or international claims that might be detrimental to the sovereignty or integrity of the country. That unambiguously covers this contract. By far, the most important national assets of the Republic of Venezuela are petroleum assets. And those assets are managed by state-established enterprises, such as PDVSA. If anything is a national public interest contract, it is this. This contract proposed to pledge a majority of the shares of the crown jewel asset of the Republic of Venezuela, putting those as that asset at risk of privatization, of risk of being divested from the Republic. Nothing could be more consequential, especially in this moment, than that. And therefore, I think both with respect to the specific exercise of authority by the Republic, by the National Assembly, the fact that it specifically invoked Article 187, and given the nature of this, of what was at stake here, it really is quite clear that this is a national public interest contract and was understood at the time to be a national public interest contract. And on that point, if I could, a couple of more things that I think are significant. First, back in 2016, Maduro was not insisting that he could unilaterally direct PDVSA to enter into the 2020 notes because it wasn't a national public interest contract. He asserted that he had emergency powers to disregard the constitutional limits on his authority and do it anyway. There wasn't a dispute between the branches about whether this was a national public interest contract. In fact, the very reason that Maduro asserted that emergency authority to disregard the Constitution was because it was a given that it was a national public interest contract. And then with respect to this dispute, I do think I want to try to take a minute and clarify it about whether the National Assembly's authority only pertains to national public interest contracts that the national executive enters into directly. And bondholders cite the Velazquez decision of the Supreme Judicial Tribunal to that effect. I want to try to clear that up. That's just wrong. It is quite clearly wrong. I would direct the court first to look at the Velazquez decision itself. It's not in the joint appendix, but it is in the record of the district court. It's docket number 128, exhibit 7, and at pages 15 and 16, what that opinion says is that contracts entered into by the national executive are subsumed within the category of national public interest contracts. It does not say only contracts entered into by the national executive directly are national public interest contracts. And it's quite clear from a decision of the Supreme Judicial Tribunal just a year later that in the ADELCA case, which we mentioned in our amicus brief, that the category is not limited in that way because the Supreme Judicial Tribunal concluded in the ADELCA case after Velazquez that a contract entered into by a state-run enterprise, the electrical company, was a national public interest contract. And the National Assembly has asserted its authority over contracts that PDVSA has purported to enter into as national public interest contracts over time. So I think with respect to that, we just don't think that you can look to Velazquez and adopt that position.
What was the purpose of commissioning the professor to render an opinion?
I think it was belt and suspenders, Your Honor. I think it was quite because, as I said, the whole fight that was going on between Maduro and the National Assembly exercising its legitimate constitutional authority was whether Maduro could get around the restrictions on his authority that Articles 150 and 187 impose. And I do think in this regard, I'd commend to the court's attention the scholar's amicus brief, which explains, I think, quite well the very purpose of these provisions in the Venezuelan Constitution, which are quite common in constitutions of emerging companies. And they are in the constitutions for the very purpose of ensuring that the authoritarian impulses of an executive be subject to check by the national legislature. That was exactly what was going on here. So I think this is a contract of such great significance that I just don't think one can maintain the proposition that it wasn't a national public interest contract.
May I ask a follow-up question? So what was the purpose of the October 2019 resolution on which I understand the parties don't rely?
I think the purpose of it was just to emphatically reaffirm in a situation in which at that point, you have to read that in the context of developments within Venezuela. At that point, we're talking about the emergence of a new government, the Guaido government, which is a government that the United States is going to recognize as legitimate, as a legitimate representative. And that government wants to be in a position to act without any ambiguity whatsoever with respect to these contracts. And so
you say reaffirm, but it does use quite different than, as I think you use the word, more, more emphatic language. And it says it was concluded that the 2020 bond indenture is a national public contract. And that's prefaced by following the investigations conducted with the Office of the Special Prosecutor. And that it at least suggests that the conclusion reflected in the October 2019 resolution followed the investigation that itself followed the September 2016 resolution. Yeah,
I don't think so, Your Honor. And I think there's some reasons, you know, apart from that's the fundamental point that if anything is a national public interest contract, according to the definition that the legislature proposed, it's this. Now, with respect to the specifics, I recall that when the Maduro regime through PDVSA offered this swap, a substantial majority of the bondholders didn't take it.
They understood the risk.
I think the fairest thing to say is they understood that the risk though is that the National Assembly had acted definitively, and their definitive action meant that the note offering was without legal authority, was void ab initio, and that indeed
40% did take the bonds, did take the notes.
Yeah, they did, and I think that's because, Your Honor, they were gambling on the proposition that Maduro would be able to stay in charge long enough to pay them off, and they would reap a handsome profit, and that if that failed, that maybe they could win a lawsuit like this one.
Seems to me the argument you're making is equivalent to saying that that the position would be identical if in September 2016 the Assembly had done nothing. If it simply, you're saying it's all obvious. It's all obvious on its face. And the Assembly could just wait until now and say, oh, well, this contract was obviously void ab initio because it was clear it was a national public interest contract. And it never had approval from the National Assembly.
So I think there's a different answer to that question with respect to the act of state doctrine and the choice of law issue, Your Honor. With respect to the act of state doctrine, there needs to be an act of state. There was a colloquy with Mr. Gottlieb about that. The September 2016 resolution was an act of state.
The act would be the not voting approval.
That would be a harder question if the question were never called, but the question was called. And the National Assembly categorically rejected, that's the Assembly's words in the resolution, categorically rejected the core term of the 2020 note provision. Now, with respect to the choice of law issue, I do think, Your Honor, that the argument could be made, even if there were no action by the National Assembly, as a matter of Venezuelan law, these notes still were void ab initio because the Constitution is unambiguous that entering into contracts in national public interest shall require the approval of the National Assembly, and that there's no argument that there was approval ever. And so if one determines that this is a national public interest contract, which, as I said, it surely is, it has never been approved. So for choice of law purposes, when applying Venezuelan law, it's void ab initio. And then we're not taking a position as a republic on how that gets sorted out. But it's certainly true as a matter of Venezuelan law that you're doing nothing.
When you say that you're not taking a position as a Republican on how this gets sorted out, the sorted out part is a big issue.
Yeah. What I mean by that, Your Honor, is that given that it's void ab initio, then the question would arise: what's the consequence? Are there unjust enrichment remedies, that sort of thing, which none of that's been adjudicated as I understand it. And we're not taking a position on that.
Yes.
But what we are certainly.
Sorry. The question as to whether it is in fact void ab initio, is that teed up for us on appeal now? Or is the question that's teed up for us on appeal now in the choice of law argument, whether or not it matters what Venezuela has to say about that question? And if we conclude that it does, if Venezuela law applies to that question, are we in a position in this appeal to then resolve that question, or does that go back to the trial court?
So I think as I understand, the parties have tried to address that, and I think they're in a better position than I am, but I'll give you my best take on it. My best take on it is that with respect to the act of state argument, if the court concludes that this is an act of state, then yes, the court is in a position to resolve it and should resolve it. And for the fundamental reason that as Your Honor's questions earlier were raising, a key underpinning of the act of state doctrine, it is the question of the relationship of the United States and foreign sovereigns. And as a point, Mr. Gottlieb mentioned it, but I want to emphasize it because I do think it's of critical importance. In ruling on the counterclaims of the bondholders, what the district court did was say that the pledge of a majority share in Citgo, the crown jewel of the Republic, is valid and enforceable. That unambiguously contradicts the National Assembly's decision in September 2016 to, quote, reject categorically, unquote, that very provision, and allows the privatization, the divestment from Venezuela, and the privatization of this vitally important asset. And that does, I also want to connect this to the point Your Honor raised about the position of the United States. I wouldn't presume to tell the court how to read the statement of interest. It's in the joint appendix. I read it. But as I read it, at least, what it says is that it would be premature for the United States to take a position on the application of the act of state doctrine until the questions of Venezuelan law and certain other factual questions are resolved. That is not, to my mind, a statement by the United States that if the September 2016 resolution is a sovereign act that exercises Section 187 authority and categorically rejects the core term of the 2020 note offering, that isn't an act of state. I don't think that's what the United States is saying. It's saying that question had to be resolved. And at the point that the United States said that, the Republic had not come to court and given a definitive statement of the Republic's understanding of the law of Venezuela and how it operates here. And so I do think that it ought to be read in that context. And with all due respect to the district court, I think the district court plucked one phrase out of Ambassador Abrams' letter accompanying the statement of interest, saying that the United States favors a consensual resolution of these kinds of commercial claims. By far the more important statement, which I think bears directly on the fundamental act of state underpinnings here, was Ambassador Abrams' statement, and if the court will just bear with me, I'll read it, that the divestment of Citgo for the Guaido government, which the United States is doing everything possible to try to uphold, would be, quote, greatly damaging and perhaps beyond recuperation. I think that goes directly to the central point here, that reinforces why this is a national public interest contract. So I've taken up a great deal of the court's time. I'm happy to answer any other questions.
Mr. Verrilli, do we determine that based on our domestic judicial approach to reading acts, or do we determine that by reference to Venezuelan law?
So I asked Mr.
Gottlieb the same set of questions. I think they're important, but
they're important, and the answer is a little complex. But yes. I think that the act of state doctrine is a matter of federal law, prescribes a federal rule of decision, requires determination that there is an act of state and what it is. To determine what it is, I think the court does need to look to Venezuelan law. I realize we're here as an amicus. Mm-hmm. And we appreciate that. We do think that animal science and the law generally says that the foreign sovereign's views on that question are worthy of real deference. You know, there's factors that determine how that deference should be applied. We think, as we said in our brief, applying those factors, it's clear that we should get a great deal of deference here. And I do think a key point is that You do have to consider Venezuelan law to some extent. And I do think the key point I want to stress is that the Constitution of Venezuela, Article 150 and Article 187, by their terms, delegate to the National Assembly the authority to decide what a national interest contract is. That's what the established by law means, determined by law means, and phrases mean in those provisions. And then
it seems to me that your argument is kind of slides over a tricky, troublesome question. I assume you're not arguing that any contract made by PDVSA with a foreign corporation is a national public interest contract. For example, if it made a $1 million contract with an engine with a foreign engineering firm to do a specific job, I assume you wouldn't be saying that requires the approval of the National Assembly to be valid. And it's hard to disagree with you that this could qualify as a national public interest contract, because it's obviously a contract of very great significance to PDVSA and a very important contract for Venezuela. But the question is whether, or one of the questions is whether the September 2016 resolution has taken the position that it is a national public interest contract and expressed itself as establishing that this is a contract that requires national assembly approval. Because without that, no one can ever know, unless the National Assembly takes a position, no contracting party can ever know whether its contract, its proposed contract with PDVSA, is or isn't a valid contract requiring whether it requires National Assembly approval. So it seems to me that whether the September 2016 resolution communicates that this determination has been made is of great importance to understanding is this simply a resolution that's raising troubling questions and calling for an investigation and asking for a professor's opinion? Or is it something that says this is a national public interest contract, and as such, it requires our approval and doesn't have it?
I'm not trying to elide that question, Your Honor. I'm trying to go directly at that question. I think that the September 2016 resolution should be definitively understood as an exercise of the National Assembly's Article 187, Section 9 authority. The National Assembly invoked that authority in conjunction with categorically rejecting the core term of the provision. It did not say provisionally rejecting. It did not say suspending judgment pending further consideration. It said categorically rejecting. And then it did go on to provide for an investigation and in further inquiry. But the further
you say invoking Section 150, but it's not so clear that it's invoking it as it would be if it said, invoking our authority under Section 150, we categorically reject the collateral. That would be a different thing, but there is at least an arguable point that what it is doing is not invoking the 150 authority, but raising the question whether the 150 authority applies, saying we categorically reject the collateralization here, and we raise the question and ask the professor to render an opinion on whether this is a national public interest contract under 150.
But they didn't do that, though, Your Honor. They didn't do that. They didn't. They categorically rejected the collateral, not subject to further inquiry. They categorically rejected it. And what they said to PDVSA was, let's have a hearing to see whether there's some other way you can protect your financial integrity. That's what they did. And then again, it has to be.
That's what the professor was asked to express an opinion on?
No, no. That's what they said. We want to have additional hearings to determine that, for you to come back and tell us right. What you might do differently to achieve this result, with us having categorically rejected your proposal for how to achieve this result. That was categorically rejected. It was never revisited. That was an act of state. It was a sovereign act, and it categorically rejected. And after all, this whole matter is about this pledge. And the pledge goes exactly to the heart of what the National Assembly defined in May, in the May resolution, exercising its delegated constitutional authority as a national public interest contract. It's a contract.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, I'm sorry. Finish.
No, please. No, go ahead. Please.
Well, I have another question. Is there any relevance to the fact that that Venezuela performed under these notes until the default? That Venezuela paid interest on the notes?
No. I in terms of their validity and the status of the National Assembly's. This National Assembly's September resolution. No.
Well, performing, the reason that I raise the question is that performing under the notes and paying interest gives assurance to the marketplace. Venezuela is not contesting the validity of these notes. We're performing under them. People who could buy them in the market with relative assurance that Venezuela has not contested their authority and is paying interest on them.
You know, that might, from our perspective, Your Honor, that might have some relevance to working out what a remedy would be, you know, an alternative equitable remedy, but doesn't go to the question of the authority of the National Assembly. And of course that, and the authority of the National Assembly and the status of the September 2016 resolution. It just doesn't. And as I said, there's no argument here by anyone ever that the National Assembly approved these contracts, which is the constitutional prerequisite for their validity as a matter of law in Venezuela. I know I've taxed the court's patience here. I just want to make one more point. It's a small point, but I suspect it'll come up in the appellee's arguments. And that's this statement by Dr. Brewer, who was one of PDVSA's experts in the district court, about the scope of the Velazquez decision in national public interest contracts. He said in a footnote in an article in 2006 that it had narrow scope. And it wouldn't apply to anything but national executive contracts. One of the reasons I walked through the analysis of Velazquez, the subsequent decisions of the Supreme Tribunal, and the acts of the legislature, is to demonstrate that whatever Professor Brewer might have said in that footnote wasn't correct. He has made clear in his expert report that that is not his view. As I said, I expect that to come up, so I just want to take this minute and clarify that, if I may. And if the court has no further questions, again, I very much appreciate the court's attention on this matter.
Thank you very much. We'll hear from counsel for the appellee. Are you there?
May it please the court, Walter Riemann for the trustee and the collateral agent as appellees. In light of what we've just heard from my colleague representing Venezuela, let me mention a few salient facts at the outset before I get to the legal argument. The exchange offer here did not provide any new money to PDVSA. The exchange offer refinanced short-term debt that was coming due in 2017. Before the exchange offer, PDVSA owed more than $9 billion in notes, in other words, bonds, that were due the following year. PDVSA very bluntly warned investors during 2016 that if the exchange offer failed, PDVSA was highly likely to default the following year on those notes. And Judge Fela made a finding to that effect. The consequences for PDVSA of a default in 2017 would have been calamitous. Those notes were New York bonds. They were enforceable in New York. Holders could have sought attachment of PDVSA's U.S. assets, including Citgo. So the exchange offer.
Why is that argument helpful to you? I mean, you are stressing the gigantic importance of this contract, which seems to me to stress the
public interest, which
we concede that it was a national public interest contract.
Well, two responses. The Article 150 question itself is not before this court. And that's something else I wanted to say in response to Venezuela's presentation. Judge Fela said that both parties had advanced substantial arguments below on whether PDVSA's contracts as a categorical matter are subject to Article 150. It was our contention in the district court that Article 150 just doesn't apply to PDVSA. It rather applies to the government itself. That issue is not decided and was not briefed before this court. So that this court is not positioned to decide questions like the meaning of the Velasquez decision for whether PDVSA's contracts are subject to Article 150 as a matter of Venezuelan law. But the importance of the exchange offer and the condition PDVSA was in at the time is relevant to another point that Venezuela made. It was argued that
You're saying to us that it is not one of the points before us whether the September 2016 resolution was an exercise by the National Assembly of its power to void ab initio a proposed contract by the withholding of approval to a national public interest contract? So that's not before us?
The significance of the September 2016 resolution is before the court as part of one of Judge Fela's alternative holdings on the act of state doctrine. She made essentially two findings on this point. She held that none of this matters because she said, even if the September 2016 resolution had the effect that PDVSA claims, it was nonetheless ineffective under Ally Bank to destroy contract rights that arose in New York with respect to debts cited in New York. So that branch of her holding does not turn on any question of Venezuelan law and does not turn on the significance of the 2016 resolution. She also held in the alternative.
Well, I mean, what you say is correct, but does that withhold from us a question which is being argued before us by your adversary? I mean, you're saying you're not arguing it. You're saying I don't need to argue it because it's not what the judge decided. But it's being argued very forcefully by Venezuela and your adversaries.
Well, that's not. I'm sorry that I didn't succeed in making myself clear. We are very much arguing that Judge Fela was correct in finding that the September 2016 resolution criticized the exchange offer, but did not purport to declare the exchange offer illegal or void under Article 150 of the Venezuelan Constitution or on any other basis. So what the September 2016 resolution did or did not do is front and center with respect to Judge Fela's alternative holding. What I was arguing is not before this court is the underlying question to which counsel for Venezuela alluded of whether, as a matter of Venezuelan law, Article 150 does or does not apply to contracts entered into by PDVSA as distinct from Venezuela. Judge Fela said that she was not making any finding on that point. She didn't need to. The parties have not in their briefs argued the question under Venezuelan law of the scope of Article 150 of the Venezuelan Constitution. And the brief for appellants expressly states that appellants are not asking this court to decide in the first instance.
Well, they want us to remand if we get to the issue of Venezuela.
That's correct. Judge Fail explained that her decision was not dependent on what Article 150 of the Venezuelan Constitution means. We think she was quite right to say that she sets forth, grounds in U.S. law and in the plain meaning of the September 2016 resolution that are fully adequate to resolve this controversy. And consequently, the appropriate action for this court, we respectfully submit.
When you describe, Ms. Riemann, the plain meaning of the 2016 resolution by the National Assembly, how do we view that other than by reference at some level to Venezuelan law?
Well, I think that it is an element of the active state doctrine in cases like this that a taking has occurred. And that is a question. The active state doctrine, as I think the parties are agreeing, is of course a matter of federal law, and its elements are a matter of federal law. So it's for this court to determine, as it was for Judge Fela to determine, whether the September 2016 resolution qualifies under the active state doctrine. So its reading in that respect is a question of federal law, not Venezuelan law. Now, Judge Fela nonetheless examined the September 2016 resolution under the factors explained by the Supreme Court in Animal Science and concluded that by reason of its text, by reason of the special attorney general's statements about the resolution, which admitted that it had not declared that the exchange offer was unlawful, and by reason of the entire context in which it was made, the September 2016 resolution should be read as criticizing the exchange offer, but not as purporting to declare it invalid. And she was right about that.
But this is the same question I was asking your colleagues. I am a little bit struggling with the way it's teed up, because everybody's clear that for choice of law purposes, we don't need to delve into Venezuela law as to the impact of Article 150. But it feels like the active state argument is simultaneously asking us to go to that same place. If Article 150 doesn't in fact require National Assembly approval for this transaction, then none of this matters, right? I mean, we wouldn't even need to talk about the active state doctrine, or am I wrong about that?
No, I agree with that, but there are alternative grounds. There are other grounds on which the active state doctrine does not apply here that were adopted by Judge Fela and that we submit are correct.
And that's the Ally Bank takings.
It is fundamentally Allied Bank. The restriction of the active state doctrine to takings within the territory of a foreign sovereign is absolutely fundamental. My colleagues have referred to the fact that foreign sovereigns cannot take property located outside their borders as an exception. It's not an exception. The whole doctrine is about actions that a foreign state takes within its borders.
But isn't it correct that in 2016, in September 2016, there was no property outside of Venezuela? All there was a contemplation of a contract, but there was no contract.
Well, but when the contracts were actually entered into, which was indeed subsequent to the September 2016 resolution, property rights arose in New York under New York law. And as a matter of New York choice of law principles, for the reasons Judge Fail explained, antecedent Venezuelan law was simply ineffective to prevent that from happening. The parties had validly elected New York law, and as Judge Fela found, the grouping of contacts test leads to the application of New York law.
So you're saying that even if the text of the September 2016 resolution had explicitly said the National Assembly determines that the proposed contract is a national public interest contract as to which Section 1050 requires National Assembly approval in order to be valid, the National Assembly hereby declares that that it is not approved, and PDVSA has no authority to enter into this contract. You're saying that even if that were said, it would have no effect under the act of state doctrine, because even though there was no external to Venezuela property at the time that this was said, out of Venezuela, foreign property did come into effect when the contract was eventually signed?
That is exactly what I'm saying, and that is exactly what Judge Fela found, that the situs test of Allied Bank is about where something happens, not when it happens. PDVSA's argument on this point is fundamentally directed to taking what is really a choice of law problem. Does Venezuelan law apply? And the answer is no. And trying to get a different answer to the choice of law problem by arguing that the act of state doctrine mandates the application of Venezuelan law here, notwithstanding its inapplicability under choice of law principles. And that, we submit, is incorrect. Judge Fela was right to find that at the end of the day, it didn't even matter what the September 2016 resolution said. But we also urge and strongly urge that the September 2016 resolution is properly read in exactly the way Judge Fela argued. She rejected the arguments that were advanced here about the significance of the May resolution. She did so properly. It referred both to assets of the Republic, and these are contracts of
PDVSA. Did she have the benefit of an amicus brief in the way that we have the benefit of an amicus brief from the Republic in making that assessment?
She did. She had a submission from the ambassador of Venezuela to the United States, which set forth materially the same argument.
So the animal science analysis and deference, she considered that.
Absolutely. Her opinion is very explicit on this point.
So, can I take you back to the premise before you pivoted back to the active state was that choice of law wouldn't get you there. And I'm really struggling with that on lots of different bases. And one is there's a series of thoughtful decisions. We talked about it in your colleague's argument earlier from the Southern District, in which it is concluded that you've got to look at the law of the issuing jurisdiction to figure out the validity or the authority for a particular commitment. And it's not at all obvious to me that wouldn't apply to this case. Are those cases wrong, or is there some meaningful distinction I'm missing?
I think there are meaningful distinctions that were pointed out by Judge Fela, who considered all of those decisions. And in many of them, there appears to have been no discussion of choice of law and no adversary presentation. But the two most fundamental distinctions for those cases are the following. Those cases were actual authority cases in the principal agent sense. So they dealt predominantly with whether a particular individual, a particular signatory to a contract, was or was not authorized by a principal, the government, to enter into a contract binding the principal. That is what, in this context, actual authority means. Does the agent have the authority to bind the principal? Now, PDVSA is trying to say that this case involves whether PDVSA was legally authorized to enter into contracts such as those that form the basis of the exchange offer. But that's like a bit of a semantic argument here. I mean, that is an illegality argument. It is an argument that PDVSA made a promise that was not lawful under the laws of Venezuela. One can always reframe an argument like that in words as saying that the entity was not legally authorized to enter into a contract in violation of the laws of its local sovereign. But that's not an actual authority argument within the meaning of the cases. It's an illegality argument.
Except when I look at, I'm looking at the Anglo-Iberia Jamstek case. That really was about whether Indonesian law allowed this kind of entity to enter into this kind of transaction. It wasn't a principal agent. And I look at the Export-Import Bank of China versus Liberia, and it was about the lawfulness of the kind of transaction under Liberian law. I guess I'm struggling with the assertion that these are all principal agent cases.
I think those cases do focus, some of them focus on the principal agent distinction, and also, as in Themis Capital and some of the other cases, focus on the application of the law with the application of the law of the most concerned sovereign. In other words, they apply a choice of law test akin to the grouping of contacts test. And here, as Judge Fela found, the grouping of contacts test points to the application of New York law. So New York law would apply. So New York law substantive matters, as a general question, Judge Fela appropriately found, applies. If there is an exception for actual authority issues as they apply to a government, which is by no means clear under the law, it doesn't apply here, we submit, in light of the fact that many of those cases focus on the principal agent problem. Those cases look at the sovereign that under normal choice of law principles, whose laws would apply. Here that is New York. There are also questions that are unique to governmental entities that are arguably in play there. PDVSA is a corporation. It is, you know, it has a board of directors. It has shares. It and not the Republic of Venezuela was entering into these contracts. So we think that any actual authority issue here would mean an issue relating to whether PDVSA validly authorized its signatories to enter into the contracts. And that just isn't disputed. PDVSA did so authorize the signatories to enter into the contract.
The New York Appeals Division had a case just in December. I've been sort of struggling with when under New York law, if ever, parties' choice of law provision can be overridden by the interests of a foreign jurisdiction in a particular issue. And in the North American Elite Insurance Company versus Space Needle, the court recognized the general rule that once the parties have elected New York substantive law, New York substantive law applies. But it found that this was a New Hampshire insurer, Washington insured New York choice of law. And the New York court found that the very strong interest of the state of Washington in enforcing its prohibition of choice of law, choice of forum, and choice of law prohibitions on policy sold there overrode the choice of law prohibition. And so one of the things I'm trying to figure out is how that sort of, whether that validates the sense that even with the New York choice of law, if another jurisdiction's very strong policy issues, interests are implicated, with respect to that issue, the balance of factors may point to looking at that jurisdiction's law.
I can't speak to the specific case that Your Honor mentions, but I think that in this kind of case, the interests of New York in the application of its own substantive law are overwhelming. We have here a transaction that everyone concedes was focused in New York. The district court runs through all of those facts, and I won't repeat them here, but it was completely a New York transaction. Bonds payable in New York, exchange offer happening in New York advisors, Credit Suisse, everything. So the interest of New York as a commercial center in the application of its law across the boards to that kind of transaction is critical. It would be tremendously destabilizing for the commercial law if ad hoc exceptions after the fact wound up.
Let me follow up on that, and then you know what? Complete your answer, if you would, to Judge Robinson, but I've got to follow up on that.
Sure. I think that is the substance of the answer, other than to say that New York case law recognizes the importance of all of these interests. We cite the cases in our briefs. And in addition, all of the interests articulated by the United States in Allied Bank are in play here. Because if a New York centered transaction with New York choice of law clauses winds up being declared unenforceable by reason of the application of a foreign sovereign's law, all of the destabilizing consequences identified by the United States and the Allied Bank are implicated.
This is my follow-up question, because as has been alluded to, 60% of the 2017 note holders decided to pass on what, at least to my eyes, looked like a pretty good deal, a very good deal. Unsecured debt converted into secured notes. And I'm very cognizant of the possible impact of any decision across the board, across cases that we make, might have on, particularly on New York as a commercial center. But is that really the case here? In other words, aren't the set of facts here sufficiently unique, and the fact that we have 60% of the prior bondholders who decided not to take a very good deal because they understood the risk associated with the possible invalidity of the issued notes. So can we cabinet in that way?
I don't think you can, Your Honor, for multiple reasons. First, there was, of course, no finding by Judge Fela as to the reason that only 40% of the investors appear
I appreciate that, but okay. I have a good guess.
Well, I would have another guess to offer, Your Honor. At the time of the exchange offer, PDVSA was concededly on the verge of default. PDVSA had said in a very explicit way to its 2017 bondholders, if a sufficient number of bondholders do not take the exchange offer, you aren't going to get paid in 2017. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a default. Now, the exchange offer asked investors to extend the maturity of their bonds for 3 years, from 2017 to 2020, for a debtor that was telling the world it was on the risk of default. That was an extraordinarily risky thing to do, even given the fact that there was a security interest attached to the extension, because as this very litigation shows, debtors have ways of obstructing the enforcement of a security interest, and that risk is particularly acute for foreign issuers like PDVSA. So it's not at all surprising from an investment perspective that many investors decided to hold on to their 2017 notes, hope that enough other investors would opt into the exchange offer to prevent a default, and hope that PDVSA would in that way limp through 2017 without a default and they'd get paid. And that is in fact what happened. The exchange offer attracted enough support so that PDVSA paid off the 2017 notes on time. But PDVSA itself was saying that wouldn't have happened if enough people don't take the offer. So it wasn't a particularly financially attractive offer. Some people took it, some people didn't. But there's no evidence that the that the extent of non-participation relates to the risk of invalidity.
I wonder whether, raising a somewhat different point, whether there is something to be said for the argument that that the wrong party, or at least not the ideal party, is invoking the active state doctrine here. Because PDVSA entered into this contract with full awareness of what the National Assembly had done by the September 2016 resolution, has acted until the moment that it was about to lose its precious, the precious collateral offered to the bondholders. It was acting in furtherance of this contract. And so it's not as if the state of Venezuela, through the National Assembly, is bringing this suit to protect its assets. It's PDVSA that's saying to the court, please protect us from having to honor all the contracts that we made and all that we have done with full awareness of the fact that, as we now proclaim it, with full awareness that we had no authority to do it. That seems to me a scarcely ideal position to approach a court and say to us, please declare that I had no right to do what I've, what I have induced others to make contracts with me.
I very much agree, Your Honor. I mean, the trustee and the collateral agent in the proceedings below asserted a ratification defense and similar defenses. And with respect to the issues that are before this court, PDVSA's performance on the 2020 notes until it was on the verge of default is contextual evidence that is important to this court's assessment of the overall controversy. I would also, if I may add, in response to a concern expressed a few moments ago by Judge Loyer, that PDVSA, this case can't be decided as a one-off. I mean, PDVSA's argument implies that when a foreign state-owned enterprise issues debt cited in New York, the issuer may disclaim the debt by arguing that the issuance was illegal under previously existing foreign law and that a court must give effect to that foreign law under the active state doctrine. And PDVSA also says that the U.S. courts owe substantial deference to the after-the-fact views of the foreign sovereign about the contents of that foreign law. And all of that would be deeply destabilizing to Allied Bank. It would open up a very significant hole.
Let me ask you something. If the October 2019 resolution, Mr. Riemann, had occurred in September 2016, and it had been very definitive, and just Fela cited based on all the interpretive tools available to her and to us, that was clearly an act of the National Assembly disapproving of the bonds, but the bonds occurred, I guess, then you might say Allied Bank, but then in October 2016, for whatever reason, understanding the risk, the note holders executed the exchange offer. Would we be in the same position? Other than the fact that the note holders would have even more knowledge that they are taking a substantial risk in accepting the exchange offer.
Well, let me try to answer that question. As a prefatory matter, of course, if the National Assembly in September 2016 had actually said that the exchange offer was illegal, which it didn't do, it would almost certainly have killed the deal. The Caracas and New York offices of Hogan Lovells had issued absolutely clean opinions, mm-hmm, saying that the transaction was enforceable under Venezuelan law and enforceable under New York law. We now know that Hogan Lovells provided a legal analysis to its client PDVSA as to why Article 150 did not apply here. The financial advisor for
saying what? Saying what? Giving what as an explanation?
Saying that making the fundamental articles about Article 150 that we made in the court below, that Article 150 does not apply to PDVSA, it applies to the government. And that PDVSA, that had been the practice, that PDVSA's practice in issuing debt and the practice of its subsidiaries for many years had been consistent with that understanding. So there were opinions of counsel here. Credit Suisse, which was PDVSA's financial advisor in the deal, has said that if it had believed that there was any substantial question respecting the legal enforceability of the deal, it would not have participated. So there is every reason to believe that if the September 2016 resolutions had actually said what PDVSA is now trying to characterize them as saying, the deal would have stopped. Hogan Lovells would have withdrawn its opinions. It would have gotten the attention of people like Credit Suisse. It almost certainly wouldn't have happened. And that indeed is the likely explanation of why the September 2016 resolution didn't do that. As I explained earlier, if the exchange offer had failed, PDVSA was faced with an imminent default. If there had been a default in 2017 on notes that were enforceable in New York courts and governed by New York law, the investors would have tried to attach Citgo. No Venezuelan government would have wanted to do that. So the National Assembly did what politicians sometimes do. They criticized the exchange offer, but they did not say enough to stop the exchange offer. And I mean, the specifics are addressed at considerable length in Judge Fala's decision. I would say in response to some of the comments you've heard that the opinion of the law professor, which was alluded to before, as Judge LaValle commented, was rendered after the September 2016 resolution. So the fact that it was requested is an indication that the September 2016 resolution was not intended to pass definitively on whether the exchange offer violated Article 150.
When was the letter from the ambassador?
To the district court?
Yes.
I'm sorry. I don't have the date in front of me. Okay. That was long after the operative events. The October 2019 resolution of the National Assembly was rendered right before the default and the commencement of the litigation. It was, frankly, it was an obvious setup for the litigation. And it wasn't until, you know, the litigation got going and the motions for summary judgment were teed up that the ambassador submitted his letter.
Okay. Am I right in understanding all your arguments about what Article 150 does and doesn't require and whether or not the act of the National Assembly was an effective repudiation? Those are alternative arguments because your core argument is, if I'm understanding it, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether the act of pledging these assets squarely violated the Venezuela Constitution because it was executed in the New York financial marketplace and New York law applies and has no concern about whether or not PDVSA was actually authorized to pledge those assets in the first place. Am I wrong about that?
I think we have two arrows to our quiver here. Judge Fala made two findings on this subject, each of which is independently dispositive of the act of state and comity arguments. She found that what the September 2016 resolution said was not even relevant because under Allied Bank, the contract rights in question arose in New York under New York law, and Venezuelan law was powerless to change that. But she also looked at the September 2016 resolution and said it just doesn't say what the PDVSA parties claim that it says. It criticized the exchange offer. It doesn't declare it to be invalid. The National Assembly, with respect to other contracts in other settings, and this is discussed in our brief, had said this contract falls within Article 150 and is illegal. They refrained from doing that here. They asked for an opinion from a lawyer subsequently. There's also been discussion in by counsel of the significance of the fact that an investigation was requested. But as Judge Fela pointed out at page 37 of her opinion, the October 2019 resolution, if I may just read a sentence from her opinion, quote, expressly admits that it was not until after, and now she's quoting the resolution, investigations conducted in coordination with the Office of the Special Prosecutor, that it was concluded that the 2020 bond indenture was a national public contract that should have been authorized by the National Assembly, end quote. In other words, the October 2019 resolution says that the conclusion that the exchange offer represented a contract of national public interest was reached after and based on the investigation to which the September 2016 resolution refers. And that is squarely incompatible with the contention that the September 2016 resolution itself found the exchange offer to be a contract of national public interest within the meaning of Article 150. As Judge Fela said, that's not what it said. That's not the way Venezuela's own special attorney general characterized it. That's not what the context suggested. And as I have argued to you, the fact that PDVSA was facing an emergency situation, an imminent default that made this exchange offer necessary, furnishes a very plausible explanation for why the National Assembly refrained from making that declaration in September 2016.
Did PDVSA deliver an opinion at the time of the contract with respect to the lawfulness of the transaction, notwithstanding the 2016 resolution?
Well, PDVSA extended all of the customary warranties and assurances about the lawfulness of the transaction in the transaction documents. I don't think one would ordinarily expect, as a matter of corporate law, that those would refer to any specific alleged impediment. And so far as I'm aware, they do not.
But PDVSA was aware at the time of the negotiations. I mean, there was discussion in the negotiations of this very question. Is that not correct? And opinions rendered to the purchasers of the bonds, you refer to the Hogan Lovells opinion that Article 150 was not implicated.
Well, let me be clear about that. Hogan Lovells furnished clean, unqualified opinions that didn't make reference, the formal opinions did not make reference to Article 150 at all. As is customary in a transaction of this kind, where the opinions simply comment in broad terms on the enforceability of the transaction documents under Venezuelan law and under New York law. We now know, based on discovery, that contemporaneously Hogan Lovells in its Caracas office and its Venezuelan lawyers looked at the Article 150 issue and told PDVSA Article 150 is not a problem here. The National Assembly's approval under Article 150 is not required. But that was
Is there more analysis in the discovery than that? Or is it just a conclusion?
There is analysis in the memorandum that Hogan Lovells prepared for its client, PDVSA, at the time. That was not public at the time. It was an internal analysis, but it was what Hogan Lovells told PDVSA. And of course, Hogan Lovells, through its clean opinions, which wound up being disclosed to investors, was saying to the world, there's no enforceability problem here.
You're saying Hogan Lovells was counsel to PDVSA, not to anybody on the purchasing side?
Well, it's not right. This was a refinancing of a bond deal, as I mentioned to Your Honor. So there were not the kinds of negotiations that might have occurred, you know, in a different kind of deal between identified counterparties. This was an exchange offer in which PDVSA was saying to all of its holders of the 2017 notes.
There was a prior relationship. Yeah.
But nonetheless, I repeat my question. Hogan Lovells was counsel in delivering this opinion, private opinion, which did discuss Section 150. That was delivered to PDVSA by its counsel.
That's correct.
So there's no question that PDVSA was apprised of the issue of whether this proposed contract was rendered a nullity by the September 16 resolution.
That's the case, Your Honor.
So did you argue in the district court that it's legally inappropriate for PDVSA having warranted to the people it was dealing with the lawfulness of the contract with full awareness of the issue to now turn its back on its prior warranty and say, no, I sucked you into this by telling you it was all lawful, but now I'm telling you none of it was lawful and you can't get the collateral?
We did rely on the warranties in the district court. We asserted ratification-related arguments, and we also asserted, you know, restitution type claims, which the district court didn't need, which did not, as it turned out, come into play because the district court properly found that the contracts themselves were enforceable. I think PDVSA's attempted position was that the transaction documents are unenforceable in their entirety, including the warranties. The district court rejected the proposition that the transaction documents were unenforceable, and consequently, those specific issues did not need to be adjudicated.
Go ahead, Judge Robinson.
No, please, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I want to go back. I asked before, and I realized that I think the active state issue has got a strong gravitational pull in this argument. And I really want to focus on the choice of law question for a second. If I understand your choice of law argument, it is that all the work that was done to evaluate the lawfulness under Venezuelan law in Article 150 in advance of the deal was essentially irrelevant because, as a matter of choice of law, this is governed by New York law, and New York law doesn't care whether or not PDVSA was authorized under Article 150 to enter into this. It's just an irrelevant thing.
It is our contention that, as Judge Fela found, the substantive law of New York governs for many reasons. And I hope to be able to address those issues a little bit more specifically, including the issues under the UCC.
UCC.
But
yeah.
But it is true. So that is right. New York substantive law applies. It is nonetheless not unusual in transactions of this kind to obtain opinions from counsel in the jurisdiction of the issuer's place of incorporation, because, you know, creditors don't want these kinds of issues. They don't want contentions after the fact that issuers are somehow not bound by contracts that are enforceable in New York under New York law. But the existence of the opinions, including the opinion of rendered by the Caracas office of Hogan Lovells isn't in any way incompatible with the contention that it's the substantive law of New York here that governs. Opinions like that are routinely obtained.
Is that opinion in the appendix?
We can obtain the citation for you. I don't have it before me.
If it turns out not to be, would you furnish it to us, please?
Of course. I have a high degree of certainty it's there, but
would you turn to the UCC?
Absolutely. Judge Fela found that Petavese's argument does not raise an issue of validity within the meaning of Section 8110 of the UCC. And we think that was absolutely correct. The term validity in Section 8110 as applied to a corporation means corporate authority to issue securities. There was a reference during the earlier argument to corporate or other authority, which is a phrase that appears in the legislative history. But in context, what other authority means there is parallel forms of authority for issuers that are not corporations, and in particular, municipalities. In other words, corporate authorization or parallel forms of authorization for non-corporate issuers. So it's about, according to the New York legislative history itself, corporate authorization, meaning the process within a corporation by which the corporation approves a deal. Did the board of directors approve the transaction? Did the individual who signed have the authority bestowed internally within the corporation to do so? And Petavese's argument is not that kind of argument. It is not a validity argument within the meaning of the UCC. It is an argument that Petavese, in entering into these contracts, made a promise that was illegal under the laws of Venezuela. Now, they say that because of the effect of Article 150, Petavese was not authorized to enter into the contracts. So this is an issue of authorization. But that's not what authority means in the context of corporate authorization. With respect to any legality issue, you could say that because a particular promise was illegal under some law of general application, the entity or the individual was not authorized to make that promise. But that's not the meaning of authorization for purposes of the UCC. It's so, corporate authorization.
Sorry, in 202 then, when it talks about the different impacts of defects in securities that go to its validity, and it talks about defects that involve a violation of the constitutional provision, how do we square that with your explanation that validity is really about internal corporate formalities?
Well, Judge Fela addressed this, and I think she got the right answer. Section 202 doesn't mean that every alleged constitutional provision bearing on the enforceability of a transaction goes to validity. It does indicate that some constitutional provisions might be of that character. And indeed, that is the case. In particular, there are a number of historical constitutional provisions prohibiting a corporation's issuance of so-called watered stock, namely, the issuance of stock for no consideration, often with a fraudulent recital of consideration to insiders or in circumstances where it's used as a bribe. And the case that Judge Fela cited indeed rests on a Colorado constitutional provision about watered stock, saying that a corporation cannot issue watered stock. More recently, prohibitions of that kind are typically found in the state's corporation law rather than in the Constitution. So all that reference shows is that some constitutional problems can go to validity, and that is right. Where a constitutional provision specifically relates to the manner in which a corporation internally authorizes an issuance of securities, it is capable of going to validity. But Article 150 is not at all a provision of that kind. It's a law of general application. In other contexts, as PDVSA's expert on Venezuelan law said, it has been applied, for example, to a contract between Venezuela and an outside entity for information about geological surveys. It is not limited to securities. It's not limited to debt. So it falls outside the constitutional provisions that are involved in Section 202. Reference was also made during the argument to cases cited in comment 3 to that section. As our brief explains, those cases are in there to establish the content of the doctrine of estoppel by recitals. They're not cited in the comment on the issue of validity at all. But as it happens, the Colorado constitutional provision underlying those cases, while it is a debt limit provision, does in fact specifically mention bonds. The word bonds occurs in the provision. And even if that were not the case, one can imagine a reasonable argument that a debt limit provision applicable to a state that finances itself through the issuance of bonds goes to the issuance of securities within the meaning of the test now under discussion. Article 150 is nothing like a debt limit provision. It is a provision of general, a law of general application. It doesn't go to securities or even to debt. It doesn't go to validity. It is just a general legality objection. And validity doesn't take that in. And if I may, I'd like to explain briefly why that narrow...
Yeah, very, very briefly, Mr. Green.
Okay. Why that narrow provision of validity is, harmonizes with New York law in a way that PDVSA's position does not. First, party autonomy and freedom of contract are foundational policies under the UCC. Section 1301 and 1302 of the UCC, among others, reflect that principle. Section 5.1401 of New York's general obligations law requires enforcement of contractual choice of law provisions and indeed overrides prior common law restrictions on their enforcement. That's a powerful commitment to party autonomy. It is true that the UCC is carved out of that, but as the New York case law demonstrates, we cited in our briefs, it's Section 5.1401 that demonstrates the general policy. The internal affairs doctrine supports Judge Fela's interpretation of the UCC. Under the internal affairs doctrine, matters that are internal to the corporation are often governed by the laws of the issuer's place of incorporation. But but Article 150, as the PDVSA parties interpreted it, is a requirement for external approval. Indeed, footnote 14 of PDVSA's reply brief expressly acknowledges that the National Assembly is external to PDVSA as a corporation. And of course, that's clear on its face. Section 203A.
I'm going to give you one more minute, unless there are pressing questions from my colleagues, but I'll let you wrap up.
I would cite New York's abolition of the ultra vires doctrine as another strand in New York law that requires a narrow application of validity. And finally, that understanding of validity would be tremendously destabilizing to New York commercial law. If it were adopted, international debt agreements with the broadest and most unqualified New York choice of law provisions would nonetheless be subject, against the will of the parties, to the mandatory application of foreign law against a broad and poorly defined swath of issues. That would be massively destabilizing for the ability of parties to New York law contracts, New York law commercial contracts, to rely on their enforcement under New York law.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We've all cut you well past your time. I'm not sure I've ever seen 41 in red. Mr. Gottlieb.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few points about the active state doctrine and one point about the comedy doctrine. So the first point I'd like to make is about this entire debate about the meaning and effect of the National Assembly resolutions. And it's this: if the Venezuelan National Assembly was purporting to deny approval of the contract, that act must be given effect, even if the National Assembly was wrong that its approval was required, even if the National Assembly was wrong that Article 150 applied. The whole point of the active state doctrine is that U.S. courts will not second-guess the validity of an official act under foreign law, and U.S. courts are not supposed to say to a recognized foreign government, we don't believe you accomplished what you intended to accomplish. That is precisely the holding of this court's decision in FTE, where the district court had said it was somewhat uncomfortable telling a foreign government that a validly enacted decree cannot achieve the result that was clearly intended by its passage. And this court said the district court had good reason for discomfort and reversed. And even if the National Assembly did not declare this to be a national public interest contract, it clearly intended to stop it from happening by disapproving it. The second point goes to Judge LaValle's discussion about the commissioning of the legal opinion with respect to the September 2016 resolution. And it's just important to understand the role of the National Assembly. The National Assembly is a first instance interpreter of the Constitution under Venezuela, but it's also a legislature. And when Congress, for example, in the United States, votes down a treaty, the fact that Congress might commission an opinion from legislative counsel backing its decision that the document is in fact a treaty does not deprive the vote of the legal significance of depriving the treaty of authorization, nor does it suggest that Congress was uncertain of its conclusion. So too, the executive branch in the United States often takes actions in conjunction with commissioning legal opinions from the Office of Legal Counsel. That doesn't mean the executive branch is uncertain about its action.
Is there any precedent in the active state doctrine litigation where the party that is invoking the validity of the active state relied on was one that assured its adversary previously that there was no validity to it, and that that what was being offered to the context of this case where a corporation entered into the contract giving rights to a litigant in the case with full knowledge of the act of the foreign government that is relied on to make that contract invalid, assured the validity, acted all along as if the contract was valid by performing it and so forth, until the moment came when there was an aspect that it didn't want to comply with, and then said, oh no, we never had the right to enter into this contract in the first place. Is there a case that replicates that where the courts relied on the active state doctrine to protect a party's ability to do that?
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, I don't agree that that's an accurate characterization of the facts in this case, but to not fight the hypo.
I would appreciate your pointing out in what ways it's inaccurate, if that's part of your answer.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, the legal line that's drawn by the active state doctrine is that the foreign government that's capable of advancing its positions in the United States is the one that is recognized and extant at the time of suit. That's the Supreme Court's Sabatino decision line that is drawn.
So I'm sorry, your microphone is not picking you up very well.
I'm going to try to put this right here. Is this better? Wait,
that's much better. Much better.
I will hold this here while I talk. The legal line that the Supreme Court's Sabatino decision draws is that the government that has the power to to advance its arguments in the United States is the one that is recognized by the executive branch and extant at the time the suit is filed. And the reason that that matters is that the National Assembly and the Guaido government wasn't capable of taking actions to challenge the validity of this prior to the recognition of the Guaido government in 2019. It was the National Assembly in Venezuela that enacted resolutions in order to stop the exchange from coming into effect. It had taken a number of other actions in order to assert the National Assembly's priorities at that point in time. It was only when the Guaido government was recognized that the National Assembly gained a number of powers. One of those, of course, was the power to represent the Republic in the courts of the United States based on the executive's recognition. But the other was the power to conclude investigations into actions of the Maduro regime, of which this transaction was only one part. There were many actions of the Maduro regime that the Guaido government began investigations into when it came into power of 2019. In fact, that October 2019 resolution references that. And so the notion that the National Assembly just sort of, or the government of Venezuela, the one that is recognized by the executive branch in this court, sat back and sort of sat on its rights, I just don't think is consistent with the facts. The moment the Guaido government came into power, it took a series of actions culminating in that October resolution.
But that's part of the problem that I think Mr. Beeman just globally is identifying, which is that then that makes every transaction involving New York note holders, security holders, prone to a significant change in expectations. How do we deal with that?
I think Allied Bank deals with that, Your Honor. And we're asking for the line that is drawn in Allied Bank to be enforced. The appellees are asking for that line to be completely blown open. The line that is drawn by Allied Bank, Mr. Riemann said that the CITES test is about where something happens, not when it happens. That is flatly incorrect. The test is about both where something happens and when it happens.
All right. And would you answer Judge LaValle's question? Go with the hypo. Is there
any authority? Is there any precedent in which the active state doctrine has been enforced in circumstances similar to this in the respect that I described?
I think this case is unique for a variety of reasons. And so I don't think there is a precise case that enforces the active state doctrine under the factual predicates that Judge LaValle has raised. What I would say is there are cases. So what I would say is first, they did not raise this argument below, this argument about the active state doctrine being ineligible. What they did is they raised defenses. So they raised equitable defenses that would account for example, a breach of warranty or a misrepresentation.
Right.
So we think those defenses are the appropriate way to account for this issue, not the active state.
Why isn't this an equitable? Why wouldn't it be an appropriate equitable defense to say that that is inequitable conduct on the part of PDVSA, having lured the persons who took the notes into the transactions with the assurance of its lawfulness under Venezuelan law, with full awareness of the Article 150 question, to now, when things turn out badly, turn its back on that prior assurance and say, well, no, too bad, you shouldn't have relied on our assurance. Because the issue is whether the National Assembly had approved, and it didn't.
So they've raised that defense, that those defenses were briefed and submitted to the district court on summary judgment, and they were not adjudicated. In fact,
but that doesn't prevent us from adjudicating them.
I think it does, Your Honor. I think that those defenses were not adjudicated, including even the consideration of the key evidence that would support our responses to that defense, which were contained in an expert report by Mr. Hinman, that the district court ruled was essentially moot because she was not ruling on the equitable defenses.
But you're saying that the Court of Appeals can't rule on an issue that the district court hasn't ruled on?
I think that the parties.
I mean, there's very explicit authority to the contrary, that especially in affirming a decision of the Court of Appeals, the Court of Appeals can affirm for any reason that's valid under law. We very frequently affirm district court opinions for reasons not given by district courts and not even contemplated by the district court.
I apologize, Your Honor. I wasn't attempting to suggest the court lacked the power to decide those defenses. I was simply suggesting that these were defenses that were raised below. They were not adjudicated by the district court. All of the evidence hasn't been considered. We have not.
You're saying that the record is not fully developed on that issue.
That is correct. And I think we have not had the opportunity to make the arguments that we would make in response to those defenses based on, for example, the expert report that was excluded. Okay. So that I just wanted to address two more.
Yeah, I'm going to give you one more minute and then we'll move on to your colleague, Mr. Bliss.
Okay. I just I wanted to address the questions that were raised about the October 2019 resolution, which my friend quoted the line from Judge Fiala's opinion saying that the resolution expressly admits that it was not until after 2019 that the assembly concluded.
Still losing your voice. I'm sorry.
Sorry. My friend referenced the line from Judge Fiala's opinion saying that the resolution expressly admits that the National Assembly did not conclude it was a national public interest contract until 2019. That is just flatly incorrect. It is not a correct reading of the text of the resolution. The fact that the National Assembly reached a conclusion following an investigation in 2019 does not mean it had not reached the same conclusion in 2016. Just like this court can issue an opinion, grant rehearing, and then reach the same conclusion after rehearing, the National Assembly made a determination, acted on it in 2016, conducted an investigation, and made the same determination. And the final point that I would just make is, I wanted to just make one point about the comity arguments. My friend said that Judge Fiala had considered the Republic's amicus brief and all of the animal science factors. What I would point the court to is that probably the key factor that the district court relied upon in rejecting the Republic's submission was the fact that the Republic was essentially an interested party that had been in coordination with the plaintiffs. And this court's decision in animal science just says that is simply not a legitimate reason to discount the weight and submission of the Republic. Which
is that a reason by itself to remand back to her to assess the value that she might accord to the Republic's position de novo and with more deference? Is that your view?
We think it could be. We don't think the court doesn't have to do that because the court can reach its own determination about the weight that should be given to the Republic's submission. But I do think it's clear that the district court was not applying the correct standard that this court has clarified now.
Unless there are any other questions from my colleagues to Mr. Gottlieb, we'll turn to Mr. Bliss. Thank you, Mr. Gottlieb.
Thank you, Your Honor. 2 points regarding UCC 8110. The district court did not limit validity to internal corporate authorizations under the district court's own reasoning. If Article 150 included the word securities, if, for example, it referred to national public interest contracts, including any such contracts relating to securities, it would bear on validity within the meaning of 8110. The court's reasoning is simply not grounded in anything relevant to statutory construction. Quickly on the grouping of contacts analysis, which the court should never have reached. The district court recognized that in a proper case, a foreign state's sufficiently compelling public policy could preclude an application of New York law otherwise indicated by the grouping of contacts analysis, particularly where New York's policy is weak or uncertain. This case implicates the integrity of Venezuela's constitutional system of government and its ability to safeguard its national public interest from abuses of executive power. On the other side of the balance, New York's status as a premier commercial center hardly depends on providing what the law professor's amicus brief described as, quote, a damaging loophole to anti-authoritarian constitutional provisions around the world, unquote. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Well argued on all sides. The case is submitted. We'll reserve decision. I'll ask the clerk to adjourn court.
Court stands adjourned. Thank you, judges. I'll transfer you now.
Thank you very much.